todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Today's guest is Allison Tabel, the director of an incredibly moving new documentary called Resonator. She's the daughter of musician and inventor Don Tabel, who passed away when Allison was just a couple of weeks old. The movie follows her quest to revive the Resonator, Don's synth prototype, sparking revelations of the darkest secrets and celebrating a life cut too short. Celebrity interviews in Resonator include Grace Potter, Peter Gabriel, and Fred Armisen. I love this movie, so I can't wait to hear more about how it was made and what the plans are for its release. Let's bring Allison on now. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I also made a documentary about my dad. So we have a lot in common. And there was also, yes, it's called The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. And my dad started The Ventures. So I could really relate.
Oh my God. Wait a minute. After this, we have to have another conversation.
Yeah. So I could relate to a lot of what you did in your documentary, although for mine, I chose not to have a personal angle and not to, you know, say I'm his daughter or anything like that. But of course, for your story, I think it was essential. And there's another documentary too that kind of reminded me of yours. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called The Terry Kath Experience.
Absolutely, about Chicago. Yeah. I've seen that a couple of times.
Yeah. And so his daughter made that, and she was also searching for an old instrument and kind of found her dad along the way. And that's what I really loved about your documentary. But what was the impetus for you to actually dive in and make it? Because it's such a huge undertaking.
Thank you so much. I wasn't really trying to learn about my dad at all in the beginning. What it was really about was just this, I was just genuinely interested in learning more about his synthesizer, because I was not a musician myself, but I toured. I was an assistant, sometimes a tour managed. And I was around all these people who would talk all day long about gear and technology and synthesizers. And so I just, I wanted to be able to contribute to the conversation. And all I really had was, hey, my dad, you know, he invented a synthesizer. And they'd be like, oh my God, what was it called? Where is it? And I didn't know how to answer their questions. I always knew exactly where it was. I knew that it was in the attic of my grandma's house, but I never cared before I toured. I never really thought about getting it out. I never had a real reason to. And we had a couple of weeks off tour, and I just decided to go dig it out. And I was thinking that I would film something like a mini doc or something about the resurrection of the synthesizer. And I would be in front of the camera learning about synths, because I didn't know anything about the technology. And I was like, maybe people could learn about it with me who didn't know about synths. And we would make a compilation album using the synth, and that's how I would be able to like engage these musicians. And I was just looking for a reason to hang out with musicians, honestly. Like it had nothing to do with my dad. It was very selfish. And then I met with one of my dad's friends who was not really offering up any information about the synth, but he was offering up a lot of information about my dad, and specifically the night that he died. And it was stuff that I'd never heard before. It got really personal and really heavy. And I remember leaving that interview just going, oh God, I'm not going to film any more of this because I'm not trying to tell that story. The world doesn't need to know about my personal life or my family's life. You know, this isn't what I was trying to do. So, that's kind of where everything changed, and I realized that I probably should keep filming because if I was struggling with something, chances are other people could relate and maybe this could help some people. So I just decided to keep filming, and then 10 years later, I finished.
Wow.
And and it's not really a story about a synth. Obviously, there's elements and that's the vessel, but it's a father-daughter story.
Yeah, I loved it. And there were so many serendipitous things as the story unfolded. And in fact, I even experienced some of that while watching your documentary because I watched it on November 28th, which is the day of your dad's crash. And it was just
Absolutely.
totally, just for whatever reason, I chose that day to watch it. So
Oh,
it really
man.
resonated with me, so to speak, in a way, because of that. And I felt like I got to know you and your dad through this documentary. And I'm wondering if you've gotten, what kind of reactions have you gotten? Because I know it played at South By and had some great screenings already.
Yeah, it has been really wonderful because what I hoped and why I put myself through this, it really has, materialized in the way that I wanted. Like the festivals have been so much fun doing these Q and A's and being able to talk to people. There are people coming up to me afterwards being like, my mom, had all these photographs, or I went home and watched all the archival footage of my dad who passed, and all of these things that people are taking away and putting onto their own lives. So that made me so happy. And the fact that you watched this on the 28th, which was the night of the crash, and today is December 3rd, the night that he officially passed. So, yeah, it's all we premiered this the documentary in Japan on the 28th, and
Wow.
that was just so cool and
It's
special.
great
And
because your dad lives on in a way through this work of yours that is so loving and so well put together. One of the things that I thought was fun was you had looked up Robert Moog when you were a kid, like you thought your dad invented the synthesizer, right? But for music lovers, can you talk a little bit about the resonator and the difference between, say, Robert Moog and your dad, Don Tavel?
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I got to meet Michelle Moog and told her that story.
Oh,
Like,
that's right. It is Moog. I keep saying Moog
you know
because
what though?
that's how
It's
it's spelled. Yeah, no,
somebody
I do
told me
know
that
that.
the name is Moog and then the synths are Moog. Who knows?
Right. It is
But
Moog.
it was just, yeah, the resonator is actually really special, and there's some novel concepts. It's this analog digital hybrid. So there's no keyboard, it's instrument controlled. So anything that produces a pitch, you can track your vocals, you could plug in a keyboard, and it has a digital pitch tracking software that my dad invented. And back in the day, that was a novel concept, and it tracked really well, especially considering the time. But then it also had this analog filters, analog oscillators, analog outputs, so that it still maintained that humanistic feel. So like a digital brain, but like an analog heart is how I describe it, which you were kind of like one or the other back in the day. And so it really was this special blend between it, like the best of both worlds,
Your dad, what was his impetus for creating it?
He just had a huge love and interest in computers, and he was a musician. I mean, that's another thing that kind of set him apart from a lot of these other creations that were coming out, was that he didn't have like Bob Moog and Tom Oberheim, they were and Don Buchla and stuff, they were engineers. My dad wasn't an engineer, he was a musician. And so his approach to this technology was from a musician's point of view, and then hired an engineer, Mike Beagle from Mutron, to help execute it. And so I think that's really what I find to be so interesting about the resonator specifically. And my dad's love of computers was just, he applied computers to everything. And he, because he really was so smart, he wasn't an engineer, but he was really knowledgeable about that. And he applied computers to music, and he applied computers to art. You know, he invented this thing called the animation station, which is like briefly mentioned in the film too. And it was just like an Apple graphics tablet. And there's an article that came out that I read that talks about how he was like trying to enhance rotoscoping using computer software. I don't even really understand that. You know, I'm still trying to figure out the resonator, but but yeah, he just his love of computers, I think, matched with his really inherently his inherent musical ability, musicality, led to that marriage of technology and music.
Well, what was the biggest surprise or sort of revelation to you in discovering the resonator and trying to put it back together again?
I mean, the biggest surprise is just that I never, ever would have imagined that I actually would feel a connection to my dad by working on his invention, right? Like, again, that wasn't the goal. And I think in Colombia, when I go to Colombia, there's this real honest moment of connection where I was in this foreign place where I'd never been, my dad had never been, the resonator had no history there. And I'd know, and before I went to Colombia, I was trying to connect with him. So I met his twin, and I met with his family, and I visited his gravesite and his crash site for the first time ever since I was born, and or you know, since he died and I was 10 weeks old. And I didn't really feel anything when I would do those things. I mean, they were all helpful in their own ways, but it wasn't, I didn't feel like I was connecting with my dad. And then I went to Colombia, and I found myself thinking so many times, oh man, I wish Don was here. He would love this. And that was language that I had never had before in my whole life. You know, I never thought, oh, my dad, wish my dad was here ever. So when we were at the end of the sessions in Colombia, we went to the beach just kind of to celebrate and relax. And I took the resonator there because I was like, it lived in a box for 25 years. I'm taking it to the beach. And I was just sitting on the rock, you know, at the top of this rock where the river meets the ocean, and the sun was setting. And the producer, Christian, who had helped me out for the past, you know, those past few days, he just looks at the sunset and he goes, there's your dad. And I got chills because I felt it. I felt this weird wave of, oh my God, I feel like he's here, you know, or I want him to be here. Like, I don't know. And so that was the biggest surprise, is what this innocent curiosity of the synthesizer actually did for me over the course of the last decade of my life.
Yeah, and also I feel like even though it wasn't your intention to start with, it was almost like the spirits were guiding you as you were making this movie, because when you rebuild the resonator, you somehow rebuild your father.
100%. And that's, I mean, that's the whole point of all of this. You know, there's these interstitial segments in the documentary where I'm in this warehouse and I'm laying out all the parts of the
Yeah.
resonator as I, you know, try to build. And that is supposed to represent what you just said. You know, it's just it's me building this man, and the parallel between who my dad was and what the resonator is.
That comes across beautifully, and always in a documentary, I think even more so than a narrative film, because there's not a script to follow with the documentary. Your editor is extremely important and a truly essential part of your team. Who edited the film, and how did you work with people in post-production to get this to its final product?
Man, I love my editors. Katherine Robson was my main editor. She came on first. She edited this documentary that I'd seen called Circus of Books, and I just love that documentary so much. And I was like, I want whoever did that. And so I reached out to her, and for some reason she said yes, and we worked together for a while. I think like a year and a half, and built this thing. And she, because I funded this project myself. I was for a while, I was like, well, maybe I have to edit this because I can't really afford to bring somebody on. And I tried some other people and it didn't work out. And I was really lost, but I knew I was too close to the story to be able to edit down those scenes. And she is a poet. Like, I don't know what she did. Some of these scenes are just so beautifully constructed and musical and poetic that I would come over and watch a scene and just cry.
Aww.
That just made me so happy. That was one of the most fun moments of making the film in the over the 10 years, was sitting with Kath and just having her blow me away with these scenes. I owe her so much. But this project took so long that she got pregnant and had a baby and had to go on maternity leave, and so I had to find another editor. And I had an interim editor, Aaron, who came on and contributed quite a bit in a short amount of time. He's the one who added the there's an attic scene at the end where I have a conversation with somebody, and that was a really hard conversation to have, but it really showed my character development. And when I was working with Kath, I was not comfortable putting that in because it was just too personal. And then I forgot, to tell him, hey, don't use this. And so he just found it and put it in. And then when I was watching this down, his edit down, I was like, oh. And then I thought about it and I was like, okay, if I can get over myself, this is a really important scene for my growth. And so we kept that in. And then finally, Chris Gibson was my final editor. And Chris is so similar. His style of editing is so similar to Catherine's that they worked together seamlessly. And he really pushed me to rearrange a couple of things. Like, most of the documentaries actually laid out how it happened in real time, especially once I read the letter. Like, everything from me reading the letter with my mom on, it is how it happened in real life. First, I read the letter, and then I visited my dad's twin, and then I went to the cemetery, and then I went to Columbia, and then I went to NAM. I mean, it really is laid out in that way. In the beginning, though, I wanted to wait on a couple of things, like the information that Gordon Baird shares with me about my dad. That happened way later in the first cut. And to Kath's credit, she asked me to put it in earlier, and I said no. But by the time Chris came around, he really did challenge me to be a little bit more flexible in where and when things hit. And I think that the film got a lot better because of it. So even though Chris came on later, again, his contributions were huge. And he also was giving us, me and Kath, notes. Like, he's been a friend this whole time. So he was involved even when before he wasn't. So it was a took a village, man.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned that scene at NAM, another sort of connection. I used to go to NAM with my dad all the time, so I'm very familiar with the show and the chaos of it all and the noise of it all.
That's right.
Yes. So when you went there, can you just give people like a little sneak peek about what happened at NAM?
I mean, if anybody hasn't been to NAM, the only way I can describe it is every single instrument that's ever been invented is all playing at the same time, matched with people trying to have conversations about said instruments over top the noise. It's just the craziest place you'll ever go. It's a great experience, but that time I went, that was my first time going to NAM. I'd never been before. I really was sick. The resonator broke. It was a tough day for me. And just, I put a lot of pressure on myself because I was building this moment up to be like, this is the relaunch of the resonator and making its debut 35 years after, stopped. My dad stopped working on the project and blah, blah, blah. And it was a really pivotal moment for me because it, by all intents and purposes, that day was, some people would call it a failure, right? And one of the biggest themes of this film is the idea of success versus failure. What is a success and what does it mean to fail? And I think my dad and I had different perspectives of what that meant. And I think that, looking back, I don't think NAM was a failure at all, but such a an important moment for me to realize where I was and what I needed to do. And then the resonator, it took 9 months to get the resonator back, and I just kept going because I talked to my mom, honestly, and because I had a community of people who were there to support me. And I knew that, I don't know, maybe the resonator might never work again. And I never did actually turn a single knob. Like, what was I thinking? But instead of getting down on myself, I let myself have a couple of days of depression, and then I just kind of kept going. And I think it's this idea of having unconditional love in your life. Like, if the resonator never worked again, I could still go home to my mom and she would still love me. My stepdad, Alan, would still love me, and I would be fine, because I tried. And I kept trying. And I think that my dad probably didn't, it didn't feel like my dad had that self-worth. I think he was really hard on himself. And because he was afraid of that failure, he stopped trying.
One of my favorite parts in the film was your meeting with Peter Gabriel, which was such an unexpected pleasure. And the words that he said to you were so wise and so gracious. Without spoiling anything, can you talk a little bit about how you connected with him and also some of the other musicians who are in the film? I know you worked for Grace Potter, and she's in it in another pivotal scene.
So Peter, first of all, the reason why I reached out to him was because I found out that his company, he had like a synth distribution company in the 80s, the early 80s, and I found this letter that confirmed them buying three of my dad's resonators. And so I worked really hard to get in touch with him and confirmed that he did remember the resonator. And so that interview was just talking about what he could recall. And then he gave me some advice, of like what he thinks I should do, with this project moving forward, which was to put the resonator into software, because my dad was always this futuristic, had this futuristic mind. And if he were alive today, he definitely would be looking at software and figuring out that part of the music industry. And so ever since then, I'd been looking for an engineer to help me do that. And I finally found one, and it's in the works. And so that was just incredible, incredibly meaningful for me. And it also, again, helped me connect to my dad, because I was like, whoa, he met with Peter Gabriel in 1980. Now I'm meeting with Peter Gabriel, about my version of the Resonator project. So it was just so cool that he gave me that kind of time. I don't think he does that a lot, and it was, I'm really grateful. And the other musicians, I mean, Grace, is such a good friend and has been with me through this whole decade of this project. And all of the musicians, I can't believe how wonderful everybody was to give me their time. I mean, don't get me wrong, I got a lot of no's. I got a lot of rejection. I got a lot of, ignored emails and stuff. But the people who said yes are the people who I love. They're the ones that gave me the time of day, and I hope that this was worth their time. And I got, I think at this point, everybody who, did a demo with me has seen the film, and it's just so wonderful. I mean, everybody came with this open. Oh, these open eyes and these all their different instruments, like Money Mark had his thing that he invented, the Echolodeon, that it included some of his dad's tubes. His dad was an electrical engineer. And like everything just had a special story. I mean, Wally Gautier, he resurrected a synth from the 1940s called the Angeline that we ran through it. I mean, Fred Armisen was, doing stand up and stuff. So like every artist came and had their own approach to it and was just so wonderful to me. I mean, Jimmy Jam has been just a total dream. I mean, he's such a legend, and he programmed this DX drum machine that we ran through the resonator, and it sounded insane. And I've just those in the moment, those demos were so stressful for me, because I wanted to make sure that they were having a good experience, and there was a lot riding on that. But looking back, just the most fun I've had.
Yeah, well, I feel like your documentary checks a lot of boxes in that it is a personal story that we can all relate to on one level or another. But then it's also great for just fans of music because you get to learn a lot about the history of not just synthesizers, but computerized music as well as organically played music. So how did you find that balance, though, to where you weren't lopsided on one way or another?
I wish that I could say that it was like this intentional. There were a couple moments where we were in the edit and I was like, okay, we kind of need to like get to the synth part because it's been a heavy family. And I think act two is definitely a lot of family stuff. And I think when we finally meet with Grace and Eric and then I go to Columbia, it's like a little bit of a relief because we have been doing family stuff for a long time. To me, there was just no other way to tell the story because I wanted it to be worth the wait almost. Like, I wanted, you have to get through this like heavy stuff and this understanding so that by the time you get to the music stuff, it's a huge celebration because it's not just fun and musical. It's this connection that I'm having to my dad. So it's doubly rewarding because you know that it's not just fun, it's meaningful. And you wouldn't be able to have that celebration in that way if you didn't know all the heavy stuff first. So I did worry for a while that if somebody doesn't know anything about this film and they don't care about synths, and they're just watching it from the beginning, I did worry that people might think it's a little slow to start and, like, oh God, what if people turn it off because it's just like, me having a conversation with my family and, do people think that this is boring? I don't know. But I don't think it's that way. I think people do engage with it pretty early on, and it's kind of like the resonator, right? Like if you're willing to give it the time of day, you're going to get rewarded. The resonator is not a plug and play thing. You can we plug it in and you get instant sounds and it's great. But if you're really trying to like figure out something, it takes a while. And I think those are the best if you have this. If you have patience and you have understanding and you let things kind of simmer, the payoff is that much better. And I also just feel like we don't have patience today in our social media world. And this film should be for everyone, but if you don't have the patience, then this film isn't for you.
Then you won't be rewarded. Yeah, that's what you're watching it
That's
for. And
right.
there is a very bitter sweet moment toward the end with the letter from your dad that you hadn't seen before. Do you think you would have seen that letter if it hadn't have been for you making the documentary? Because it did surface while you were doing this.
I mean, yeah, I think this documentary has been such a gift for me because even meeting my dad's twin, I never would have, I mean, never say never, I guess, but so many times in life we say we're going to do something and then we never do it. And by doing this documentary and hiring film crews and saying I'm going to make a documentary and saying I'm going to finish, it kind of held me accountable to do all of the things that I said I would do. And so obviously I didn't get to do everything that I set out to do, but for the most part I actually did. And it rallied my family to find things and dig up photos and dig up letters. And yeah, I think that by doing this documentary, it opened up a lot of doors that had I not been trying to investigate, I don't think I would have uncovered as much.
Yeah, and it really gave you I guess, a fuller experience in the end because you had kind of walked in your dad's footsteps with the resonator. So, what's coming up with the movie? Is it going to be streaming, or is it going to be, is there a theatrical release, or how can folks watch it?
Depending on when this airs, I think December 13th is the day that it'll be available to rent or to buy on digital. And the pre-order starts December 6th. So I'm hoping that we get a lot of pre-orders. I think that the more pre-orders you get, that will help the platforms promote it on their end too. So I'm really going to try to rally people to come out and support it starting December 6th. But yeah, December 13th, it should be available everywhere.
Yeah, I think it's a great holiday gift too, like for as a digital gift. So you don't have to mail something, you know, you could give them the
Okay, that's
gift
a good
of
idea.
yeah, the Resonator documentary. So definitely something that I think, you know, kind of bringing families closer together around the holidays is a good gift. Now, is there social media or a website where folks can get info on this?
Yeah, my Instagram handle is @resonator and it's RESYNATOR. And the website is just resonator.com. And so I update both of those things pretty regularly, especially now as things are developing and happening and stuff. So yeah, those are the two places to find it.
Okay, and what's next for you, Allison?
Oh man, you know, I had never made a film before. This is my first film. It took me 10 years. The idea of trying to think about what's next. I mean, I've had a full-time job this whole time. That's a big reason, another reason why it took me 10 years to do it is because I had to have a full-time job this whole time. So I was touring for a while and then I had to leave tour to stay in LA to be able to finish the film. And then I had to get a job that kept me in LA. So I started archiving for the Tom Petty estate. So I'm the estate archivist and I love that job and I'm going to keep doing that job. So as far as films, I need to make sure that this one gets as many eyes on it as possible because I put myself through this for a reason so that it would get shared. So until it's out fully and I feel, you know, I feel that I'm ready to close this door. I can't even think about anything else. I mean, this is the hardest, craziest thing I've ever done. So I need some time.
I don't blame you, but yeah, it's fantastic. I recommend that everyone watch it, and I thank you, Allison, for being here today.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening. She's buying it from